Welcome to Political Rewind. We're glad to have you all with us. We're starting the week with a great panel. Of course, Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is here. We haven't said recently, Jim, that our listeners can read you on Thursdays and Sundays in the actual Dead Tree edition of the paper.
Or they can go to Politically Georgia.
Oh.
And ultimately pay $3.99 a month. I think I'm worth a dime a day, don't
you? Subscribers, right?
Right.
Senator Nan Orrick, Democrat, is with us.
Thank you.
A subscriber to the AJC. You couldn't not be if you're an elected official.
To the AJC and to the New York Times, of course.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. and the stranger is back with us. It has been Brian Robinson, Republican strategist and former communications director for Governor Nathan Deal, forever since we've seen you. We're really glad you're back.
Well, thank you. I would have loved to have been back last week, but I was stuck in Chicago after the Notre Dame game and couldn't get back in the middle of a hurricane.
You've been living. We have to take a minute.
What kind of hurricanes? The kind you drink or the kind you blow in?
Oh, my goodness.
Well, actually, I want to take a minute about you and Notre Dame. I mean, you've been living in the UGA dream world for the last couple of weeks. I know you're a big Bulldog fan. But here's why I want to talk to you about it. You posted some pictures on Facebook at a tailgate party in South Bend before that Georgia game with none other than
Speaker Paul Ryan.
What the heck? How did you hook up with him?
Well, we wanted to reach out to some Irish fans and show that we can be, you know, bipartisan on the football field.
He's a good Catholic.
His brothers went there, I found out. Here's how. It's a Georgia connection, Bill.
Okay.
And it's something people don't know here. But Alpharetta's own Brendan Buck is a UGA grad, and he is the communications director for Speaker Paul Ryan. And I was at this tailgate, and Brendan Buck walks up and taps me on the shoulder. And so I knew Speaker Paul Ryan couldn't be far behind. And so that's how all that came about. So my whole family got to meet him and talk to him. And I got a chance to say to him, I know you're catching heck from all sides right now. And I just want you to know that I support you. And I love what you're trying to do. And he just said, comes with a job. So he was a really nice guy.
Did he give you any insights as to how he's going to pass a tax reform bill?
I said, are you guys going to be able to get anything done? And this is a response. Back off. We're at a football game. You know?
But I thought it comes with the job.
Yeah, that comes with the job too, right?
Nan Orrick, any interesting people that you've run into lately at any sporting or cultural? You're a cultural
person. Half of Georgia was in Chicago.
Yeah.
I was there see my young son, Daniel Orrick, and his wife, Emily, who are expecting my first grandchild, and to see Hamilton. So I didn't hang out in the sports venues. I did the Hamilton Broadway Chicago version. Highly recommended.
You want to sing any of it for us today?
My name is Alexander Hamilton.
Okay.
Don't tempt me.
And
now
you're in the room where it happens.
All right. Okay. You know, one of the reasons that I want to be able to have you all say a few words like that is because we've started this. I mentioned it on the show the other day. Every now and then, listeners say to us, we really love listening to the conversation, but sometimes we're not quite sure whose voice is whose. So the more opportunities people can get to know your voices, thank you for doing that just now. All right, Jim Galloway, it's pretty amazing how all of a sudden healthcare, which we thought was dead and buried in many ways, well, not dead and buried, but certainly had fallen off the top of the list of items we thought we'd be dealing with. It's back in the news in any number of ways.
In two specific ways. Number one, you've got Bernie Sanders and 15 Democrats in the Senate going hard left trying to pass single payer. It's got no place. It's not going anywhere, but it's one heck of a statement. And then on the other hand, you've got a last chance, a last-ditch fight?
Yeah. Lindsey Graham of course, South Carolina, Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, two members of this, Republicans in the Senate, have come up with a repeal and replace plan. Before we even get to either of those, though, there's some bad news for Georgia consumers of all that. And Georgians, just like the rest of the country, we're getting close to the deadline to set rates for next year, insurance companies to set rates. And the insurance companies are now saying it was going to be bad. we were already looking at maybe 25% increases. The uncertainty about what's happening with Obamacare and subsidies is such that consumers better be ready for
40%
that. And so this, Brian Robinson, is this is hard news for people out there who have been on the exchanges.
You know, I'm really nervous because as a Republican, the last thing that I want to do is see us move toward a single payer. And the one way that we make that politically feasible, and it's going to be really hard for Democrats, particularly the considering this is the far left of the Democrat Party, to achieve this is to make this the current system so bad that people are just willing to throw their hands up in the air and have the government take care of them. Essentially, it's not what we want as Americans. We have withstood the calls for this as the rest of the industrialized world has done it. But a crisis,
to wit.
Well, I think what you're seeing from Bernie Sanders is an acknowledgement that Obamacare has failed. That's what this is. It is an acknowledgement of failure.
How do you spell failure? 22 million people's lives now insured that weren't before. How does that spell failure?
Then why do we need a single payer, Nan? This is so great.
We need to perfect our health care system. We need to get in line with the rest of the industrialized nations of the world and have a health care system for all.
I want to step in because I do want to have this conversation, but I'd kind of like to walk through some of the developments that are very immediate and that will have an impact first on consumers. And then we'll get into the larger question of what we do next. So, Nan Orick, two things are happening in the Trump administration that are leading to unsettled insurance markets. One of them is the Trump administration has not been clear in terms of what it's going to do about subsidies to people of $50,000 or less in income who need them if they're going to be on the exchange. But also, simultaneously, our good Georgian Tom Price, HHS secretary, he had announced this earlier, but suddenly the people who work in navigator offices, the offices around the country that help people sign up on the exchanges, they've been told they have their budgets lowered, but they're not just being lowered. They're being cut to
the bone.
They're
being decimated. There was one organization, I cannot call the name correctly, that was getting $2.2 million last year.
Here in Georgia.
Mm-hmm. This year it'll get $325,000.
Which, of course, Nan, will effectively make it a little bit more challenging for consumers who want to get into an exchange to understand how to do
Absolutely.
That. And that. Now, in the defense of what Tom Price has to say, they claim that this has been a very inefficient use of money, that there have been millions spent and the number of consumers reached has been really minimal, and so they feel they're doing a good service. What's your response?
It's a shame to see a doctor creating barriers to people accessing health care. I'm sure these aren't happy times for Tom Price to be in that posture, but unfortunately we've got an administration that is really in a position to undermine the healthcare policy and are trying mightily to do that. This is an example. I've known the Navigator system, and as our good friend Jim Galloway says, it's been funded here robustly, and it's gotten out there and reached out to people. It's been a resource. The average Joe sitting on their living room couch who's been put out of a job and doesn't have coverage does not know where to start on this, and everybody doesn't have instant internet access at their fingertips. This is a mechanism that was put in place to make the system accessible. Sadly, I recall back to the Tea Party days when Nathan Deal was busy with all the stakeholders gathered around the table creating a state exchange and participating in the affordable health care system until the Tea Party goes ballistic the minute that the bill gets introduced.
I was looking through my email today, and of course I got there was a note there from Ralph Hudgens, state insurance commissioner, announcing that Obamacare rates were going up, and he blamed it specifically on Obamacare. At what point do you think does it sink in that this is now a bipartisan
problem?
Mess.
Mm-hmm. Well, considering Obama blame President Bush for everything under the sun for 8 years, I would say maybe we have an 8-year window. But I think realistically, that the onus is on the Republicans in Washington to find something to replace it. it's one thing to politically let Obamacare fail, which perhaps you're doing by giving the uncertainty in the exchanges
and giving it a little push here and there.
Yeah, and cutting the navigator money. That's fine. I can accept that premise. But if we're going to undermine Obamacare, the onus is on us to have a replacement. And that's why I'm glad we're going to talk today about Cassidy and Lindsey Graham and their bill in the Senate to empower states, to give them block grants. That's what Governor Deals have called for time eternal, and it's what many Republican governors across the country would like to see. But let's get it passed, because if we don't get it passed, we are going to have to make sure that the people in the exchanges get their subsidy, there's some certainty exchange, because the Republicans will get blamed moving forward from this point on.
Well, and Brian, you've had some real front row experience in the large process that the chamber here in Georgia led a number of stakeholders. And let's get Georgia specific and let's see what we can do on the ground here in Georgia, since we were one of the 19 states that backed away from expanding Medicaid and wind up being at the bottom of the barrel when you start reconfiguring and going block granting and that sort of thing. We're very hurt by that. There's the renewed conversation here in Georgia. The chamber is involved in that, the hospital association, the stakeholders. And with your extensive background in working with that stakeholder group, I wonder if you think that there's some positive developments that can come from an initiative like that here in Georgia.
Well, you know, the groundwork that the chamber's Georgia Healthcare Access Task Force laid actually provided us with several blueprints that could still be used if we went to a block grant program. Now, one thing that task force did was create much more conservative alternatives to Medicaid expansion that would be have work requirements, have maybe a skinnier benefit package so that it's more sustainable for the state. And those blueprints are still out there. And so if we move to this block grant approach, which was always going to be hard to get through if a Democrat had won the White House this time around, now we have Tom Price, we have President Trump. So if we get these block grants, those blueprints that we laid forward would still be good pathways for the state of Georgia if the Medicaid expansion stays in place in whatever reform comes
federally.
Along. Federally.
Well,
yeah.
You know, the problem with block grants is that what's at the end of that is a waiting list for Medicaid. A block grant comes in, and when the money's gone, the money's gone. It doesn't matter if our state has the need and we have uninsured people that need the services. It's the end of the road. There's a brick wall there. That's the problem with the block grant.
That's just it. At some juncture, we have to make choices.
I'll tell you what. One other quick item about things happening in Georgia, and then we will turn to a broader discussion about both the Bernie Sanders plan and the Graham Cassidy plan, and that's that Blue Cross has announced that it, too, is now reducing its service areas out of concern for what might happen here in Georgia, Jim.
Right, yeah. In July, that was the big blockbuster that for the first time in forever, they weren't going to be offering insurance coverage in Metro Atlanta.
Yeah.
They were only offering it in the exchange areas where it was the only competitor.
All right, so it is surprising at a time when we thought the big question that we'd be discussing certly in Washington would be the tax reform bill. Suddenly we're talking Obamacare. When we come back, let's take on both Bernie Sanders' plan and the Graham Cassidy plan. This is Political Rewind.
GPB News has reporters across the state. We are uniquely positioned to cover big stories like Hurricane Irma.
Southwest Georgia was hit by two tornadoes back in January that killed 19 people. While recovery from those storms continues in Albany, the city now finds itself in the track of Hurricane Irma.
Amber and Travis Combs had hundreds of reasons to stay. They own an exotic pet store in Guyton.
Heavy rains and high winds began to build before dawn in Augusta.
Listen to GPB News. We cover the state of Georgia and we stand with the facts.
All right, we're back on Political Rewind again. We're going to make sure everybody knows whose voice is whose. Why don't you go around and tell us who you are, starting with you, Nan?
Well, I'm not Alexander Hamilton, actually. I'm Senator Nan Orrock, representing Atlanta, East Point, College Park, and Hayteville.
I'm Brian Robinson. I'm a Republican strategist and a communications consultant.
Okay, got that voice.
And he's a new dad, too.
I'm a new dad.
And I have grandparenthood in my near future.
Well, congratulations. Jim Galloway, so You know, we thought that repeal and replace was long dead. But it strikes me, and you'll respond to this, that the fact that Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy of Louisiana have brought back a new bill now tells us everything we need to know about how urgent it is for Republicans politically to do something to try to keep a promise on one of the big issues they've campaigned.
Yeah, this is all based around the concept of budget reconciliation, making an adjustment to the current budget as money is being spent. The problem is, of course, that the fiscal year ends September 30th.
Yeah. Yeah.
After that, you can't do budget. And you go up to 60 votes.
Yeah. So the Republican plan, as we discussed briefly, the biggest component, well, there's several components. One is it would take the billions of dollars in federal subsidies, money that's now earmarked for health care, and send it to the states in the form of block grants, giving states much more latitude to determine how to use that money. The Graham-Cassidy bill also eliminates the individual mandate, which many people would say is crucial, because without an individual mandate, you don't get enough people buying into the system to cover.
Then you get the high-risk pools.
You get high-risk pools. And third, it would make deep cuts in Medicaid, because the bill would end the expansion of eligibility under the Affordable Care Act, which has extended coverage to 13 million people, those states that did choose to expand Medicaid thanks to Obamacare, now would lose that right. So this is a huge bill. They still need 50 votes. Rand Paul's already said he sees it as Obamacare light. He's not going to support it.
This is all about John McCain.
Yeah, so once again, John McCain. So Brian, you've talked earlier about the fact this was something that your old boss, Governor Deal, has embraced over the years. But we're still waiting for a CBO score on this, which will come. They hope they're trying to get it expedited. They want to vote next week if possible, because they're going to have to. The CBO score isn't going to look a lot better based on what we're hearing than any of the previous scores, which show many millions of people losing their coverage.
You know, at some juncture, I think we need to focus on the fact that this would empower the states to do it as they see fit. And so if they want to make sure that they have a robust benefit package that covers a lot of people, they have the right to do it. If your state wants to take a more conservative approach, the way that Georgia would, the way that South Carolina, Alabama, and Texas would, then they have the right to do that.
Why is it conservative to limit access to health insurance? Why is that conservative?
It's conservative.
It seems to be wasteful in that you're not providing the access to preventive care and entry-level primary care physicians, instead of winding up at the hospital emergency room at a vast expense to the taxpayers with a stroke from not having your blood pressure treated.
Well, we really
Why is that
do,
conservative?
We really need a low-cost community health care center type approach to prevent to solve some of those issues. But the issue isn't to just have an unending entitlement. There is no limit on what the federal government can spend on Medicaid. And at some juncture, it's unsustainable. I think we're probably past the point of it being sustainable already.
Don't you understand how much more it costs for people not to have health care? The data is there. The studies have been done.
And there needs to be a new approach to it.
And we save lives and we save money by giving people access.
We do not save money by giving everybody health insurance.
Okay, let me ask you. The one aspect of the most politically problematic aspect of single payer is that you would be requiring healthcare providers, your average doctor, your surgeons, your nurses, to take pay cuts.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, this is, look, I think what we're having here is a discussion of who gets the money and how much.
Which is what all politics is, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And
that's a problem with treating healthcare as a commodity. Yeah.
And right now we've got a healthcare system where the people who make the money are the insurance companies and the healthcare providers, specific healthcare, not every worker. And that would go away under single payer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's what makes it just puts it politically out of reach right now.
Yeah, I think we'll watch how this unfolds. But poor Mitch McConnell, I mean, maybe he wants to take this on. Lindsey Graham says he's all for trying to make this happen. But oh my gosh, Nan Orrick, this is another huge boulder to roll up a huge cliff. It's you know, Prometheus Unbound at this point.
And and it's been an embarrassment for the GOP. You know, on repeated occasions in the short few months that this administration has been in power.
All right, well, let's look at the other side then. In the midst of all this, as we discussed, Nan, Bernie Sanders stands in front of a podium with about a dozen high-profile Democratic members of the U.S. Senate, Kristen Gillibrand, one of the most prominent ones to his side.
Yeah, you have Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have out of New Jersey,
Cory Booker.
Cory Booker.
You know,
was
all
there.
All of these names.
Potential presidential candidates.
Exactly. You're hearing. you can see 2020 for
me. The public sentiment is in favor of expanding. People's ability to get health insurance
that's
reliable.
Payer, universal coverage.
Yeah, you know, people are for it. People are for it when you say, do you want people to have health insurance? Well, sure, of course I do. Okay, mm-hmm. How about this? Follow-up question. Are you for a single payer if your tax rates are going to go up by 5 percentage points, if your bracket's going to go up 5% more, if you're going to pay $1,200 more a year in taxes, are you for it then? Well, no.
No, actually, the data shows that you pay $1,200 per family less a year when you have people covered, because people that have a health insurance plan like I do through the state of Georgia, which continues to grow weaker and more frail and feeble with each day going by, but people that have health insurance, which is about 89% to 90% of Americans, people that have that are so fraught with all of the frustrations of trying to get the insurance company to pay that they think, oh, my God, that you're going to put more on me?
All right.
No, in fact, you're going to lessen the burden.
All right, but Jim Galloway, I think it's time to hold Nan Orrick's feet to the fire a little on this. Single payer. There may be some liberal Democrats considering running for president who stood with Bernie Sanders, but this is no more popular in the Democratic Party than...
I think you've had kind of Nancy Pelosi kind of, Steny Hoyer just kind of saying, no, make this go away, please.
Nan Orrick, our Democrat, this is part of... The Democrats search for their soul. Who are they? What do they stand for? Your party? Of course it is. You're giving me this.
What do you mean? We have the first president in the history of the United States who is able to substantially reform and expand and improve.
Okay, but I'm talking now about single payer universal coverage.
So the search for our soul. we stand on the fact that this president, against all odds and with no cooperation from the Republicans, put in place. He revamped the health care.
Okay, Nan. Okay, let's cut it. Yeah.
But it's saying that they have one.
Be quiet. Just a second. Oh. I got to ask a
question.
Always,
Jim. I want to hear
you. Ask a question. Okay. Are you for single payer or improving Obamacare? You personally, which way would you go?
Oh, I think that the best system is single payer. That's what I think. And then you move over into the political landmines, and it's always the challenge of what's politically viable, feasible, because you have stakeholders, as you pointed out, on all sides.
And you have in Bernie Sanders' bill a little codicil there that said that it's a little backup plan that is just simply make some fixes in Obamacare.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's hidden in the language. Mm-hmm. Brian Robinson, Catherine Cummings tweets to us, single payer sure looks good during this conversation. But as a Republican, I would think, to some extent, you've got to be licking your chops to think about the battle that this could set off within the Democratic Party, the philosophical battle over how to deal with health care. Single payer has routinely been looked at as an extremely liberal solution to health care, and the party is not united behind it.
You know, whenever Republicans are circling the wagons and shooting inward, I like to look over my shoulder and notice that the Democrats are doing the exact same thing. And this is an example of that. This will divide the Democrats. You know, Republicans don't have an agreement on how we should move forward. There are those who think we should just completely abandon Obamacare and drop people off their insurance that they got through the government and go back to what we had pre-2009. I don't think that's where the majority of Republicans are. They realize there's got to be some middle ground that we can capture. But the Democrats, this has split them wide open. And I do think that Nan is right. This is the soul of the Democrat Party. The soul of the Democrat Party is on a complete 100% health care takeover of by the federal government, just like we have in the VA. And guess what happens? When you have a system like the VA, you have rationed care. And that's what we would go toward. And so people who've had private coverage, Dan, it's true. And let me tell you, Nan makes it sound like this is all easy. This is all gonna be perfect if we just have single payer.
Now, did I not say you move then into the political realities of all the landmines that are out there in crafting a solution?
I do think, Brian, we'd have to do, maybe we can turn it over to Jim's friends at the AJC who check these facts. The notion that we are going to go to rationed care is certainly a subjective conclusion you're reaching.
I think it's an objective conclusion.
I think we have always rationed care. It's just a matter of who does the rationing. Is it the insurance company?
Or the government.
Yeah, and I tell you what, I'd cast my lot with the government where you can vote people in and out of office and have the public have some ability to weigh in with an opinion as opposed to the private insurance industry that has just raped and pillaged. Come on now. We all know that. And there's a whole slice of the docs around the country that are sick and tired of spending their money on having 6 and 8 staff to cope with the insurance companies. And any doctor will tell you that. I have those conversations repeatedly with doctors. We've got a broken system. This president, Obama, in his presidency, went further than any other president has been able to do to get enough stakeholders in the room to put together a significant reform that ensured over 22 million people.
All right, we want to move on, but I want to give Jim and Brian one last crack at this.
I think the argument that the way to reduce red tape and paperwork is to hand it over to the federal government is a non-starter with the American public who has ever dealt with the U.S. government. And two, let's not forget that President Obama promised us in 2009, 2010, that everybody was going to get covered, we're going to have better coverage, we're going to keep our doctors, and cost would go down. That was the premise. That was the promise.
And they interrupted the trend line.
Jim?
The most important person in this debate over the next 12 days is going to be the governor of Arizona, because John McCain says that's who he's going to listen to to decide how he goes. If he goes for this bill, that's 51 votes with Mr. Pence in there. And I suppose we go to conference to find out what we've really bought.
All right. Liz Flowers, our good friend Liz Flowers, who works with the Democrats down in the state Senate, tweets to us, a solid discussion on health care policy that improves lives will not divide the Democrats. Liz is doing her job, isn't she, Nan, sending out that message? Yes, she is.
actually, I think she's accurate. I think she's accurate.
I hear you. All right. Let's take a quick crack, Jim, because it continues to get bigger and bigger at the scandal that has just blossomed, mushroomed enormously in our own backyard. The Equifax breach is not getting any better. Since we were last on the air, the Attorney General of Georgia, now Chris Carr, has entered the investigation with a number of other states' attorneys general who are also looking to see how this breach took place. There are reports that there is an investigation underway or about to begin on the executives who sold their stock before this news became public, presumably after Equifax was aware of it.
Yeah,
right. Although
after.
Equifax... Mm-hmm. Hedges a little on how they deal with that
timeline. About $1.8 million.
And two top executives, IT executives of the company, resigned on Friday. And Barry Loudermilk, Representative Loudermilk, is now finding himself behind the eight ball because legislation that he previously sponsored, which would protect giant financial institutions like this from class action suits, is suddenly being thrown back in his face as if he's trying to protect Equifax.
Because right now you've got Roy Barnes and a whole other set of attorneys trying to fashion exactly that, a class action suit.
Yeah.
And this is what's really interesting here is, and Brian was talking about this before we went on air, is this... This really kind of underlines the fact that the internet and cybersecurity with it has been kind of a no rules zone, And and there is no, there is very little state regulation of when it comes to cybersecurity or what what companies within each state are mandated to do. In Georgia, I think you, it's Georgia has a law that says you have to report breaches, but it doesn't say when, and it imposes no penalties for not doing it. You've got a federal one, two, three, four, five, six federal bills that have been sitting out there for years that have gotten no traction that are suddenly being dusted off now to see if we can, if there is a nationwide set of rules that
you
can be applied.
I recall very well, and this is to the question of Equifax lobbying. It's been reported that they spent $500,000 on lobbying to try to lower regulations and create more of a bandwidth and a margin for error for them. That is where Barry Loudermilk apparently comes in. He's been a recipient of a lot of Equifax contributions. Now, I remember when Georgia Watch, a consumer watchdog group, was seeking here in Georgia to put in the very simple thing that a consumer had a right to put a freeze on their credit over at Equifax and the other agencies. And that was fought for at least three, if not 4 years, to get a very simple concept passed that was already in place in some other states. They have exhibited enormous muscle on having their way and not serving the consumers
and not being held accountable. They are a major employer in the area, and they do spend their money at the state capitol when it comes to campaign contributions and lobbyists.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting because, as Eric Tanblad pointed out on Friday, they're not only a major employer, but they've been a very active part of the community. Rick Smith, the CEO of Equifax, is a past chair of the Metro Atlanta Chamber of Commerce. He's been incredibly active in community affairs
that's the way it works.
On behalf. Well, no, I'm not excusing. Yeah. I'm actually saying it for a different reason, Brian. I'm saying it because of two things. Number one, to the best of our knowledge, every single one of us in this studio, listening on the radio, sitting in our control room, has been affected by
this breach.
And a company that has been a huge part of this city is in significant crisis. Who knows where it's going to end for them?
Yeah, that's right. You know, one thing that our calculation here is a little bit different than the rest of the country, because you're talking about a potential harm to our workforce, people losing their jobs if there's any downsizing, or if Equifax has to do a huge payout for Roy Barnes's class action lawsuit and whatever lawsuits come about. But I think the important thing for Georgia politicians in the federal and state level is to take this a step beyond Equifax. What happened at Equifax is, in the words of Senator Blunt, who's seeking regulations, is a disaster. I think that's probably close to an accurate word. Even people, regular people like me who have nothing to do with this industry, I now have to go and freeze my credit, take all these steps. I need a navigator. I need Tom Price to give me a navigator.
That's right. If you can get through to Equifax. You know, the head of our GBI said he'd been working for 4 days.
Yeah, he did.
So, Brian, what you're telling us is that you are advising your Republican friends to hop on this thing.
I think that Republicans could seize on a really good populist issue, since we look for those areas where we can. Trump did it very, very well. Because people are left vulnerable through no power of their own. This is not a matter of individual responsibility. We have no choice in our economy but to engage with these credit agencies, with technology companies that have our personal data. You've got to do that to be involved in e-commerce or to talk to your friends on Facebook.
I think what you're saying is really important, and I frankly hadn't given it thought before you started talking about it. This is a perfect, Jim, bipartisan issue. There is no reason why Republicans and Democrats on the Hill ought not be able to work together on protecting our personal data.
The EU does it.
If there were a center in Congress, I think this is where this bill would fall.
Very well put, Jim.
I'm not sure that there is, but it's one of those issues that you could use to create a center.
Yeah. I love that. Thank you for bringing that up, actually.
And it's interesting because, I mean, I cannot call their names right here off tip of my tongue, but there are efforts. There are members of Congress of both parties that are saying we want to look for pathways to come together and work for common solutions.
This would be a great
one. Exactly.
All right. We're going to have to take a break, but we're going to do a lightning round before we take the break. I didn't forewarn you of all this, but you can deal with it. Last night, Stephen Colbert said on the Emmy Awards, "I wish we could have some way of telling how many people were watching this broadcast. Unfortunately, there is no way to be able to do that." Do any of you, did any of you watch the show?
The Falcons were on, Bill.
At that moment, he brought out Sean Spicer at a presidential lectern, as if he were in the briefing room, to say the exact quote that he used when he came out to announce the largest crowd ever.
For the inaugural.
I want to know what this notion of normalizing Sean Spicer is all about.
I agree. It's highly offensive, and it started a Twitter storm about, wait a minute, Spicer's supposed to be in on the joke now about lying to the American people for, you know, the entirety of his time behind that podium?
The risk of humor.
I thought it was an odd choice by Spicer. I mean, I get why a Colbert, who has been just getting enormous ratings going after the Trump administration. But I did think it was bizarre, Brian, to see Sean Spicer replay one of his biggest embarrassments in that job.
I think it's brilliant for Sean Spicer because he's got some personal reputation rehabilitation to do.
Well, that's true.
I mean, he had a humiliating term at the White House.
That's going to happen to a lot more members of the GOP, by the way.
And look, and people like us, we're regular people. He has a family to support. He has a mortgage to pay. He's got to bounce back. And so to be able to play along with the joke, I think, is going to be an important thing in his rehabilitation.
You heard it. Brian Robinson, a Republican with a heart.
That's right.
Let's take another break.
Or a self-interest. I mean,
we'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, Hillary Clinton. She has a new campaign memoir. We'll talk about candidate and President Trump, chance of lock her up, Russian interference, Comey in the emails. I'll start by sharing with her my takeaway from the part of our previous interview that went viral, the part about how she came to support federal marriage equality. My takeaway is probably not what you think it is. Join us.
Fresh Air this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Nan Orrick, it's already September 18th. Are you beginning to think about what you're going to be looking at for in the legislative session in January? Do you already have some thoughts about what you're going to want to get involved with?
Well, we'll hope to be a part of the conversation on where we go with health care in Georgia. That is, the Lieutenant Governor's had a select committee up. Looking at that, there have been people coming down from Washington and testifying. And so that question looms very, very large.
And will play a role in the governor's race, obviously, yes?
Absolutely.
Are you on the budget committee?
I am, and the finance committee as well.
Okay, so you are going to have at least a little bit of a hint of how much money we're going to try to spend to lure Amazon.com into Georgia. Because that's going to be a big line item.
What about it? Yes. And now, I believe the agencies have been told, again, don't ask for any more money
by
the governor. But,
right.
but yes, that Amazon
Are you prepared to be supportive of a big chunk of money coming from the from the budget to help that effort,
you can call it bribery, you can call it economic development,
right?
It's called a tax expenditure, is what it is. It's when we're giving money out. We're taking our public tax dollars and putting them in the private pockets of someone to get them to
engage
in behavior.
I have
historically been very, very skeptical about larding up the private sector with taxpayer dollars to
even
influence
for 50,000
jobs, average salary $100,000 and more.
And the detail, as they always say, the devil is in the details. And there have been times when I have supported. I've supported actually the film tax credits. Mm-hmm. And I represent a district with loaded up with creatives, loaded up with people that work at all levels, painters, union folks, creatives in the film industry. And they made a compelling case for that years ago, and it was bipartisan. And so that's one that I have supported. And we have gotten, in the top five states in the country attracting the film industry. But what we don't have is an adequate commitment and a system and a protocol to scrutinize the benefits of of tax expenditures. That's what we need.
I apologize. We have several people. I mean, this is certainly just anecdotal. Several people have said that if Nan Orrick, they would spend $1,200 to $1,700 a year on health care if they could really get a policy for that. Thank you for tweeting that. There have also been a couple tweets saying, don't be ridiculous. So it's going both ways in our Twitter feed right now. Jim Galloway, this Alabama Senate race that comes up, I think the election's
strange.
A week from tomorrow.
Yeah, 25th.
Yeah, it's getting stranger. This is the special election to fill Jeff Sessions' seat in the U.S. Senate. The Democratic race isn't in doubt, but you have a Republican contest between Judge Roy Moore. We've talked about him before, removed from the Alabama Supreme Court twice for violating federal court orders, against an incumbent appointed by Luther Strange, appointed by the now resigned governor, resigned in disgrace governor. And Bannon is with Roy Moore, who is an arch conservative. Trump is with Luther Strange.
And so is Mitch McConnell.
And Mitch McConnell wants Luther Strange.
And so you have
strange bedfellows.
Well, yes. Okay. All right. I like that. You'd make a great headline writer. Okay. All right. So you've got the most popular politician in Alabama, who's Donald Trump, supporting Luther Strange. At the same time, you have one of the most unpopular politicians in Alabama, Mitch McConnell, supporting Luther Strange. And you have to decide which candidate you're going, which endorsement.
Which version of Luther Strange do you like?
Brian, this is a Republican field. How do you figure this out?
I would start by saying, I don't think that we need to overread the tea leaves here as far as what it means about Trump's popularity in Alabama. Strange's problem really isn't so much Mitch McConnell. That's what's being used against him because it's tied to this establishment that Republican-based voters don't like or don't trust. But people in Alabama's problem with Luther Strange isn't Luther Strange, and it's not Donald Trump. It's the fact that he was the state's attorney general. He was investigating the sitting governor. The sitting governor then appointed the guy investigating him to the Senate and then had to resign in ignominy.
But at least he didn't get indicted.
And there's one the sitting governor then wanted to schedule the election ratifying this in November 2018.
Right, yeah, to give him a full year and a half in office. Yeah.
An incumbency. And then the new governor came in, and she said, no, we're going to do this right now.
Well, there's a lot to unpack on this. But, of course, one of the most – we should also add that this past weekend, Mo Brooks, Representative Mo Brooks, who was also in that Republican primary, finished third, spun everybody's heads around by endorsing not Luther Strange, the establishment candidate, but by endorsing the ultra right candidate.
That was coming down the pipe.
Roy Moore.
We saw that coming.
Okay, then I'm wrong about that, but it's not the first time I've been wrong. Even today, I'm sure.
Well, you know what's interesting. You know what I take some pleasure in reporting to our listening audience is that of the last six special elections for seats in Congress, Democrats won, I believe, five of the six or six of the seven, and that's right. In Trump territory, in states and districts where Trump was up by anywhere from 10 to 20 points, Jim is scratching his head, and I guess I'll have
so
to get data.
Okay, so you're not talking U.S. House races. You're just talking any kind of races.
No, I'm talking about a special election.
Okay, yeah. Right.
Okay, so here's some interesting things about this to expand the conversation. One is, of course, that there is a strong feeling, Brian, that if, in fact, Roy Moore pulls this, two things could happen. Number one, there are those who believe, and I will see about this, that if Roy Moore, who is so unpalatable to a fairly large percentage of Alabama voters, I think, beyond the Republican Party, that it does give the Democrats at least a little opening. I don't know how much of one. What do you think?
Alabama today is one of the most Republican states.
Okay.
in the country, much more Republican than Georgia is.
So I think, the Republican
wins. Oh, yeah. They don't have an Atlanta.
There's no Atlanta, man. And I tell you, if Roy Moore was the Republican nominee in Georgia, I mean, Nan Orrock would just, they would just be slobber rolling down her face.
Oh, my goodness. What
licking her chops at the excitement because they'd have a shot. They don't have a shot in Alabama. The Republican is going to win.
But what
we will see, and this is interesting for Republicans and Democrats to note, if Roy Moore is the nominee for the Republicans, we will see what the high water mark for Democrats in Alabama is.
And that's the candidate is Doug Jones. He's a former federal prosecutor.
Yeah.
He has restrained himself, and unlike John Ossoff, like John Ossoff, he has tried not to make this race about Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what he may be hoping is that if it is indeed Roy Moore that he's facing, then fundraising becomes a little bit easier for him because the Democrats have been holding back on this race.
All right.
I
would also say, just point out, if Moore is the person that goes to Congress, if Moore is the one that wins that election, that is such a dark day for Republicans. Because it shows the ascendancy of the crazy right wing in that party.
Well,
there's nothing about Judge Moore that you can brag about.
Well, in fact, that was the other thing I wanted to ask you about, Brian, what Nan's bringing up. If Roy Moore is able to unseat this incumbent mainstreamish Republican, is this Steve Bannon's green light to get out there with his minions and fight to unseat all the other Republicans or many of the Republicans who have been have not been willing to go against the party?
No, and it's partly because Alabama's demographics and its Republican Party electorate is different than it is in many states. The Republican Party in Indiana is not what it is in Alabama, where you have a much higher level of Christian conservatives. And that's what Roy Moore is appealing to here. You know, he got kicked off the Supreme Court, the first time for refusing to take the Ten Commandments off of the courthouse, and then the second time for refusing to enforce the Supreme Court.
Well, for actually instructing judges not to marry gay couples.
Not to marry gay couples. After the U.S. Supreme
Reactionary
Court.
Reactionary to the core.
So it is issues that speak directly to this evangelical base. And that's going to be about 30% to 40% to 50%, depending on the state. And Alabama's got an extraordinarily high base of that. So it's not going to be that way everywhere else. Now, I think Bannon and them are going to make that argument. I think that they're going to probably take that fight. I think the problem is that many of these candidates who are in that mold are fatally flawed, and we've seen it over and over again. You saw it in the Missouri race with Todd Akin, then the Indiana race with Murdoch. They have a hard time getting to 50+1 in a general, and that's going to be the problem with that tactic.
And then they become a problem for the Speaker of the House to control if they get up there in a House seat or in a Senate seat for Mitch McConnell, and you get these far right wingers.
All right, we only have a
couple. Dems have the same problem, by the way. Just to point that out.
We have time between now and a week from Tuesday to talk a little more about this race, and we will. One last quick shot, and Jim, I only take a few minutes on it because it's going to be the big news for the rest of this week, starting probably tonight. But I don't know how much you say about it. The UN General Assembly session started today. Donald Trump is in New York. He'll be holding a lot of meetings, but he'll also give a speech at the UN. And presumably,
we've got our fingers crossed.
You know, and North Korea. I mean, what the heck do we imagine the president is going to be able to ask the General Assembly to do in terms of North Korea? What tone is he likely to strike? We have no idea, of course, but it's a thorny problem.
No, and I think what he has to do is he has to present it as a dire problem, and in language that you don't use on Twitter, you know, explain that we now have proof that the North Koreans have the missile capability, probably to hit Guam. That's that last that rocket went over Japan, but it had distance for Guam, and that you've seen Nikki Haley, you've seen McMaster. Start echoing Trump's decision not to rule out violence.
Yeah, Nikki Haley was pretty explicit about that, saying that we do have an option.
What she really said, I think, was that we've exhausted all things here at the UN. There's really nothing else to do at the UN. I believe she said something.
What you did see today with Mr. Trump was he is back to reading from a script.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And that's very important.
That's exactly what we need. I think some of the highlights of the Trump presidency have come when he has bowed to staff and written the and read the prepared remarks. This situation is of such gravity that we cannot be shooting from the hip. I think that he's got some wise people around him, from General Mattis to his chief of staff to McMaster to former Governor Haley. He needs to listen to them, and I think he needs to really tone down the rhetoric in front of the UN, because a lot of those UN members are looking for a chance to humiliate Trump. They hate him. He's not popular amongst many of our traditional allies, much less our traditional adversaries. So yeah. I think taking a dour, serious tone, we're all in this together, we're all in danger, that's the way forward.
All right, I think that I'm just going to say that there are many steps that can be taken to work with China, Russia, and other UN Security Council members to tighten the sanctions, to address the question of their oil sources. There are things to do in measured ways.
Okay, I've got to interrupt real quick. There's a word about Tommy Irvin, the public service for Tommy Irvin tomorrow in Atlanta.
Public memorial service for him tomorrow, 11 a.m., Second Baptist Church on Ponce. Sam Nunn, Roy Barnes will be giving
longest-serving constitutional officer in the history of the state of Georgia.
Used
42
to call him
years
Mr. Democrat.
Ag Commissioner, Mr. Democrat. All right, we are just about out of time. I do want to make a couple quick announcements. First, in regard to the next rest of this week, we have a great show lined up for you Wednesday. We got two mayors here. Teresa Tomlinson, the Democratic mayor of Columbus, will be back in our studios, and she's going to be joined by Republican mayor of Sandy Springs, Rusty Paul. We'll talk a bit about what the mayors are dealing with in terms of the Trump administration and many of the problems that have nothing to do with Donald Trump. Thursday on Two-Way Street at 2 o'clock, we're finishing up the editing on a show I think you're going to love. Emily Saliers, more than 30 years, part of the most popular singer-songwriter duo in the country, the Indigo Girls. Emily's released her first single album, her first solo album. Cannot wait for you to hear the conversation. She brought her guitar into the studio. We sang along with her. So that's Thursday at 2. And Jim Galloway's back with me on Friday when Todd Rehm will be joining us again. And I, honest to goodness, just can't remember who the Democrat is on the show. But we have one. Finally, I want to tell you a little about something we're doing tomorrow night that Olivia and Tyler and Jenny and I are all doing tomorrow night at Emory University. They are about to celebrate at Emory, at the Center for Ethics there, the 200th anniversary of the publication of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which is a book that has much more to do with ethics and the value of life than it does with monsters and scary stories. And tomorrow night we're going to do a program in which we'll talk about Frankenstein, and we'll also unveil a portrait by one of the most famous portrait artists in the United States, Ross Rawson, taken from the novel of Frankenstein. It's a free event at the Schwartz Center at 7 o'clock. It's called The Unveil of Frankenstein's Creation. You can look it up by Googling that. And if you want to join us, 7 o'clock tomorrow night at the Schwartz Performing Arts Center. We'd love to see you there. That's it for us today. Thanks to the panel. See you all again on Wednesday at 2.